ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
G'day, Angus Furley here. Coming up on the Country Hour, do you consider carbon reduction and net zero when you're buying food? Well, if you do, you're in a small minority of consumers. And you'll get more on the Victorian Parliamentary Inquiry into pig welfare and hear from one pork producer which is installing security systems after a spate of break-ins by activists. And Australia's largest wine producer says robots will be running its vineyards within 5 years. Get in touch on the text line. That's 0467 842 722. New research from public relations company Porter Novelli has found 80% of Australians say carbon reduction and net zero have little to no influence on their food choices. It finds rising hip pocket pressures are making consumers more budget conscious when it comes to food choices, although considerations like Australian made, animal welfare and fair pay for farmers are still important to them. Rhys Ryan, Chief Executive of Porter Novelli Australia, says when it comes to environmental, social and governance, known as ESG issues, food marketing based on net zero isn't cutting through to consumers.
I think it's really talking about when you're standing in the supermarket aisle, is a brand's or a food producer's progress towards net zero top of mind? Is it influencing the way that you're purchasing food? And I think Australians are extremely pragmatic and probably a little bit sceptical. And so they're sort of very hard to understand abstract notions like progress towards net zero really aren't sort of spurring people to take practical action when it comes to choosing maybe one food product over another. I think that's really where it's coming from. Whereas sort of much more local, tangible, specific actions that food producers are taking can really resonate with people in a much more effective way. And that might actually cause them to choose one brand over another.
Okay, so given that most people don't worry too much about those considerations when it comes to their food choices, why is there this marketer or marketing fixation in some quarters on those considerations?
Well, I think it's a tough environment because ESG initiatives are sort of an inevitability. There is rising expectations from activist groups, from governments, from institutional capital, and it's been a positive for the agricultural industry probably overall, that as these sorts of different ESG initiatives come through, we've seen some real improvements to the way that we produce food. But all those initiatives have a cost. And I think when it comes to food brands, they're trying to recoup some of that cost through extra volume, you know, in the supermarket aisle. And so I think sometimes that leads to some perhaps not so effective ESG-based communications, you know, on food packaging or in advertising. And I think, you know, sometimes it's really about the way we communicate it, not necessarily what it is. So to give you an example, I think, you know, telling people we're going towards net zero, I don't think that necessarily resonates. But if you can talk to people about a local effort you're making to maybe put a huge behind the meter solar plant on your food processing plant that's going to really lower your impact on our environment, I think people can see, oh, okay, that's a practical thing you're doing. It's going to save money. It's going to save electricity. It's going to help our environment. And hopefully it might even make my food products cheaper in the supermarket aisle. That all those things are a sort of a win-win-win for consumers, producers and brands. So I think it's more about showing people practical action and not talking in sort of lofty, airy, abstract taglines that people can't really get their heads around.
And at the moment, of course, with high interest rates and really strong cost of living pressures, is it just the case that the hip pocket has to win out for a lot of people?
100%. I think that, you know, we sort of say in our report that 13 interest rate rises will harden Australians' hearts. But I think it's probably, you know, it's not so much hardening their hearts. It's just a practicality. It's a reality for people when they're buying food. But I do think that when it comes to spending in the supermarket aisle, Australians are interested in notions of fairness and interested in practical, tangible things.
And the other things that the consumers are telling you they do care about, those things like Australian-made, fair pay for farmers, looking after animals, those things ranked relatively highly?
Yeah, so they were the top three factors influencing Australians in their purchase decisions: animal welfare, Australian-made, and fair pay for farmers. And when you think about Australia, all those things are associated with notions of fairness. And I really do think that Australians are ultimately really interested in fairness.
The report also highlights some contradictions when it comes to food choices. For example, of course, that widespread rejection of caged chickens, but people not being concerned about what might be relatively equivalent farmed fish. Well, why are there those contradictions?
I think there's two things when it comes to caged chicken versus farmed fish. One is, I was really surprised, but when you think about it, you know, the activism against caged eggs has been now, goes back to the 1960s. I think that farmed fish is an issue that is very locally specific. So for most Australians, it's just not front and centre for them.
So overall, Reece, the marketers who come up with these messages to sell these products based on various things, whether it's net zero or whatever else, do you think they're actually tuned into what the everyday consumer cares about?
Well, I think that one of the things that we should be clear on is that Australians are not one monolithic group. They're very different in terms of different age cohorts and where people live, city, country, that sort of thing. I do worry sometimes that people who are doing the marketing for food brands are mostly living in the middle of very large cities, and they're surrounded by other people who live in the middle of very large cities, and they see a lot of the activism that happens in the middle of very large cities, and perhaps the way their marketing is maybe falling on deaf ears in other parts of the country. So I think that might be one thing to consider. But also, I think ESG is really a commitment that businesses make to be more responsible as a business. Doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be able to use it as marketing. And I think that's where there's a bit of a breakdown there as well. Making sure you're operating responsibly is something you do to make sure that you're not a laggard. It doesn't necessarily mean you're a leader.
And are there inconsistencies in the level of scrutiny on particular parts of agriculture? So the report talks about, for example, the fixation on methane from cows and the relative lack of scrutiny on the massive water use in producing almonds?
Yeah, I think what we found is that certainly from what we know as communicators who work as specialists in agriculture, what we assume people know is not necessarily the case. So the fact that, you know, it takes a lot of water to produce an almond, for example, is probably something that people don't necessarily know. I think people would see the almond as the most sustainable, product in the supermarket, and that's probably up for debate. And so I think that we can't assume a level of knowledge about agricultural products. I think we have to educate and keep communicating to people about how these products are made, where they're made, and what efforts their producers are making to farm them more responsibly. I think, you know, there was a study I'm sure you're aware of that going back about 10 years that something like a third of all Australian school children thought that yogurt grew on trees. I think we have to assume that people don't necessarily know and start from scratch when we're communicating these things.
So just finally, Reece, returning to your earlier point, when it comes to the marketing and the selling of the food, should producers and food companies, should they be focusing on those honest, real stories of food production rather than vague net zero platitudes, etc.?
Yes, I think that there is a great deal of scepticism about brands that come out with marketing that tells you, we've got this all sewn up in a neat bow, we're on our way to net zero, and we've got it all sorted. I think that Australians respond much better, and all of our research shows that we respond much better to brands that are honest about where they are in their journey and what local, tangible, specific actions they're taking to be more responsible as a business and to produce their food in a more responsible way. And if that means that we are saying that perhaps our progress isn't as good as we'd like it right now, but we're going to be honest and transparent about it, Australians will give them a big tick. I like to say that progress is a proxy for achievement in Australia when it comes to ESG. I think that if we can communicate our progress on real actions we're taking, then that to me is a much more powerful way to communicate how you're doing business more responsibly rather than talking in terms like net zero, which people don't actually really understand.
That was Rhys Ryan. He's Chief Executive of Portana Valley, Australia. A few texts on the text line. Paula Mildura says, as a mainly vegetarian consumer, I take carbon reduction as a given. Then there is my budget and food miles and food waste to add in. Overall, I try to get a positive environmental balance. David Lake Tyres says, I have no interest in carbon production when purchasing food. I think this net zero gig is just one big government con, ultimately increasing profits and government revenue. You can text in 0467 842 722.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, let's revisit that parliamentary inquiry into pig welfare that's been taking place in Melbourne this week, because one of Australia's largest pork producers says it's being forced to install security systems on farms after break-ins by animal activists. Earlier this week, footage shot by activists after they broke into a Central Victorian piggery was shown at that parliamentary inquiry. Emma Field's been sitting in on the hearing, and here's her report.
Sunpork Group is Australia's largest pig farming business, as the company's chief executive, Robert Barneveld, told yesterday's parliamentary inquiry. Their scale is mind-boggling.
Sunpork itself farms 52,000 sows, has more than 1,500 employees producing more than 1.1 million pigs a year. That equates to about 90 million kilos of pork, or 450 million meals a year. We've got 48 farms across four states. We have another seven farms in New Zealand. We're supported by two abattoirs, a value-add plant and four feed mills that produce about 300,000 tonnes of feed per year. Our abattoir in Queensland processes 95% of Queensland's pigs at a rate of 12 pigs per minute when it is operating at full capacity.
He says animal welfare is central to their business success, and have invested millions into better methods of farming.
We continually invest in improved facilities, and that's removing confinement, reducing confinement, encouraging investment in research, and particularly around additive things that exceed the minimum standards, such as enrichment, for example. Both of our organisations are significant investors in animal welfare research to continuously add value and to improve animal welfare on a continuous improvement basis.
But Kenton Shaw from Sunpork says recently one of their farms at Shepparton was broken into by animal activists, and they're now investing in farm security upgrades.
Been a very trying time for the management and this very passionate staff on site. They have really suffered in terms of mental anguish and stress, and they get quite concerned when they're working till 11 p.m. at night, and all of a sudden they notice that there are people walking across paddocks with shining lights trying to invade the farm. They've discovered cameras being put on site. They've discovered returns of time where people have come and to get the cameras back again. We now have to divert investment away from things like improved animal welfare to security. So we're now investing in fencing and locks and gates and security systems to protect the staff and our facilities from these illegal activities. And to me, that's a real travesty, because I've always felt that as a farm, we should be open and we should behave like a normal farmer. We now have to rethink that to protect our staff and our pigs and our facilities from illegal activism that has never been prosecuted.
Northern Victorian pig producer David Wright told MPs of his lived experience of mental health trauma brought on by worrying about activists.
But to live with that anguish continually, it's not a pleasant thing. And so I know the anxiety I live through. I know the anxiety that I'm medicated for. And part of that burden is from what we live with. Both Tim and I have been on a phone call with a producer whose wife rang us because he was suicidal, because he'd had activists on his farm. Like, we sat there and talked to a guy for an hour and a half to 2 hours because of where he was mentally. So that's the real life burden of what these people are doing. That's not even discussing the biosecurity issues and the welfare of the animal that they're jeopardising when they're doing it. Then we see it go to court, or we see businesses like APL raided, CA Sinclair raided, their whole production line shut for 2 and 3 days. People arrested, go before the courts, and nothing happens. We're not seeing the judicial system back up the laws that the government's done a great job to bring and put into place.
And several practices used in pig farming, such as the use of blunt force trauma to euthanise piglets on farms, tail docking, which is done to reduce tail biting among groups of pigs, plus the use of carbon dioxide to stun pigs prior to being slaughtered, were all examined in the hearing. Edison Alvarez, representing global food processing company JBS, spoke at the hearing and says carbon dioxide is the best method to stun the animals prior to being killed. But under questioning from Animal Justice MP and Chair of the Inquiry, Georgie Purcell, Mr. Alvarez says they won't be installing cameras to capture the gassing process.
Oh, we do have CCTVs in the processing facilities, yes, we do, mm-hmm. where there is mainly where there is interaction mm-hmm. between animals and stock persons, mm-hmm. yes. And we do have a lot of CCTVs as well in the kill floor, in the boning room for other reasons, safety, food safety mm-hmm. and other.
One thing that we've heard from other witnesses is accusations of footage being manipulated and not being an accurate representation of what goes on. Would you support mandatory CCTV of gassing of pigs?
If that was to increase animal welfare of any shape or form, yes, but there is no evidence at all that it would. So,
I mean for consumer confidence.
Well, we have a bunch of other things for consumer confidence.
Yeah, I'm sure you claim to. My question's around CCTV. Would you support that?
No.
Okay.
Not in the gondola if it was not to increase mm-hmm. or improve yeah. the animal welfare.
That was Edison Alvarez from meat processor JBS, ending that report on the Victorian Parliamentary Inquiry into Pig Welfare, put together by Emma Field. You can get in touch on the text line 0467 842 722. But right now, let's go from that pig inquiry to the other inquiry that's been happening this week, the Senate inquiry. Well, we've heard from a whole bunch of food and fruit and veg producers at that inquiry. And we did get in touch with someone who first got in touch with us, and that's a Goulburn Valley fruit grower who says he hasn't made a profit in 3 years, and that unfair supermarket pricing that we've been hearing about is the main reason why. Bo Silverstein from Silverson's Orchards near Shepparton says after 27 years of farming, he's considering pulling up stumps and leaving the industry.
I've been going backwards for the last 3 years. I'm actually thinking about selling. One of my third generation, my sons are fourth. It really wasn't the plan. Not that I really had a lifelong plan, and fortunately, farming isn't the greatest with or without money, but there was no other plan, up until now.
So what has been the last straw, I guess, in that decision?
Pretty much the supermarket pricing and the way they go about it, the way they get away with it, at the end of the day, it's just their pricing. Somewhere along the line, the money disappeared. So there's really not even enough room to reinvest. So I could do another block, put myself a couple of $100,000 in debt, hope and pray that it all pays off in the next 10 years, or is it just going to get worse? The prices, usually this time of the year, we have some increases on the new season fruits, but we're still selling old season fruits, which is another thing I think the supermarkets have planned out so they don't have this new season thing that they would necessarily pay more money for. Just trying to even it all out so there is no ups and downs. They can just give us one standard price all the time. Even the way it gets to the shelf in the supermarket, that's quite disappointing. We all see it when it leaves the shed, and it looks nothing like what you buy on the shelf.
So what are the main differences that you see?
Well, it's just all in good order, it's all arranged well. Like some of the supermarkets, they just tip it straight out onto the shelf. You know, people have gone through a lot of trouble to make it look pretty, and then the supermarket just, I don't know what they do to it, to tell you the truth, but it never looks the same.
And speaking of looking pretty, another key concern for you and your business is the specs that supermarkets have. What are your thoughts on those?
Yeah, well, I just think they're a little bit off what the consumer would actually want if the consumer knew what we had to do to get to those points. You know, like Pink Lady colouring. Like in the beginning, I think, it used to be 30-40% maybe, or 40-50%. Then it went to 60-70%, and then it was like 80%. And, they've gone away from that a little bit now. But to do all those things, we've got to do crazy things. Like I've spent $5,000 a hectare in previous years pulling off leaves in order for the fruit to get colour. And the colour doesn't make the fruit taste any better. The consumer just got told they wanted this thing.
What kinds of changes do you want to see at a policy level or from government on this?
Well, I suppose they need to implement some sort of control. Like there's got to be a fairness factor where we actually get paid more than the cost of production. Like cost of production could be added up and averaged over the with all the orchards in Australia or whatever. And like it's not a magic number that nobody knows. We know it, and all we're asking is that we get above that so we can continue. So some sort of, I don't know if it's going to be, what are they talking about, a 40% markup as a maximum? Something like that might work. In turn, I think something like that might make them lower their prices. We sell more fruit and they don't necessarily need to pay us more money. Because if there's more fruit flowing out of the doors, well, then we're selling more quicker and there's not stuff in storage. And then maybe we can get back to the point where we were.
That was Bo Silverstein from Silverson's Orchard speaking with Faith Tabaluyan. A couple of people on the text line. Gordon from Ballarat texting in about the supermarkets. Gordon says the power that supermarkets have in the Australian supply chain is madness. It's been allowed to happen by successive governments. My bin is now getting so full of single-use plastics from all that packaging. We are trying to work out how we can change something on our side. But it is so difficult when everything is packaged. Thanks, Gordon. This person says, in what civilised society do you trash the law to respect the law? Animal activists are spoiled children. And Anthony at Coleraine says, g'day Angus, regarding the situation in the pig industry. It's frustrating when an entire industry gets stamped over individual cruelty. Those found guilty of such acts need to be held accountable, but not the entire industry. Thanks, Anthony, 0467 842 722.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, let's leave those inquiries behind now and talk cannabis, because more than 100 people met in Melbourne this week to discuss the future of Australia's medicinal cannabis industry. It's an industry that has grown rapidly since Australia legalised cannabis for medicinal use in 2016. And the market for that medicinal use alone is now worth an estimated $400 million a year. And that's tipped to double by 2030. Victorian Upper House MP and member of the Legalised Cannabis Victoria Party, David Edishank, says cannabis represents a big opportunity for growers if legalised broadly.
A study that's been done by the Victorian Parliamentary Budget Office, who are very conservative in their estimates, has put the value of the Victorian illicit market at around $1.2 billion per annum, which equates to about 85 tonnes of product at a street level.
If recreational cannabis were to be legalised in Victoria or in Australia, what kind of opportunity do you think that presents for producers here?
That's a really interesting question, and I think there needs to be a good debate around it. I know certainly you do have these very high quality, very highly regulated medicinal cannabis producers. But we've also talked to a lot of farmers, a lot of croppers, that are very keen to be able to produce or to cultivate cannabis across a whole of plant approach. So that covers hemp for industrial purposes through to cannabis with higher either CBD or THC levels, which have medicinal purpose. And so that will be one of the really interesting challenges. And I know that at this point in time, I don't think there's a really well thought through consideration of what that sort of reform in rural and regional settings is going to look like. But if you look at the dollars behind cropping for cannabis, yeah, it's pretty attractive.
Where are we at with legalisation of recreational cannabis in Australia at the moment?
The ACT has done it, so it went under the label of decriminalisation, but in reality it's legalisation in the sense of there's no penalty so long as you stay within the limits of the Act there. With the exception of ACT, we're really not seeing a lot of progress on the reform of being able to legally access, although I don't think there's any lack of conversation around it.
Where to here in Victoria in terms of the policy that you want to see happen?
So I guess we're pursuing a two-stage approach. The first stage is what we're calling ACT Plus, which is just to allow personal use, home cultivation, sharing with friends, not sale, not barter, just sharing. After that, we're calling on the government to set up an inquiry process to what a commercialised market would look like. That's a significantly more complex question than simply the legalisation of personal use, and we think it does warrant both expert analysis and also a broader community debate. There's lots of models abroad, so we should be looking critically at the different markets, the different commercial markets that have been established, and developing a market for Australia or a regulatory framework for Australia that is the best of the batch, that which is going to be a good fit, that's going to balance an appropriate supply and distribution network with an appropriate health promotion and product quality system. And that will be a significant exercise, and we'll hope that Victoria is going to lead the process, as it did with the legalisation of medicinal cannabis in 2016.
That was Victorian Upper House MP David Edishank speaking cannabis with Elsie Kennedy. And the Victorian government said back in December that it did not support legalising recreational cannabis, but said it was open to further discussions and would consider the advice of experts. Interested to hear from you if you're a farmer growing things. Would you be interested in growing cannabis? Let me know. 0467 842 722 is the text line. 28 to 1 though, so better crack on to rural news now. Today that's with Jane McNaughton.
Good afternoon, Angus. The past few days have seen record amounts of rainfall in Western Australia's remote central and southeast, with some pastoral stations having to evacuate homesteads. Carnegie Station is 350 kilometres east of Wiluna in the Northern Goldfields. They've had 230 millimetres of rain since Saturday. However, Jess Carlew says despite the current difficulties, the rain is welcome.
We're all safe here at the moment, and we haven't been able or haven't had to evacuate, so we're pretty good so far.
So what's the past 48 hours been like? Have you received a lot of rain?
It's been wet and humid. Yeah, we've gotten quite a bit of rain, and it hasn't really cooled down much. It's still quite warm. Just over 230 mils of rain. Normally when we check willy weather or windy weather and they say we're due for over 100 mils, we're sort of expecting 10, and we don't sort of get too excited because when we do get excited, we don't get very much. So we weren't expecting this much at all.
What does that mean for you now? Is this, you know, a welcomed amount of rain, or is it too much?
Yeah, definitely welcomed. We're really happy with the amount, and it's pretty much going to set us up until next summer. And because it wasn't your typical summer rain where it was midsummer and it dries up as soon as it touches the ground, it's sort of got a chance to soak in now that the weather's starting to cool down. So it's going to be more beneficial for the country.
With Ramadan underway and the religious festival of Eid fast approaching, Indonesian importers have ramped up orders for heavier, ready-to-eat cattle from Australia. There was a serious delay of live export trade with Indonesia this year, with the Indonesian government taking them till the middle of February to release import permits for 2024. So the rush is now on to get cattle into the system, and a lot of ships have headed over to Queensland, which is putting pressure on some yards, as Lucy Cooper reports.
At the Dalrymple Sale Yards in Charters Towers, 90 minutes inland from Townsville in North Queensland, 40,000 head of cattle are set for export in March alone. An incredible feat, unseen for years. The previous high throughput was sitting at around 32,000 head in 2018. Whilst an excellent achievement, livestock agent Liam Kirkwood says It's actually a matter of the industry essentially playing catch-up.
Export permits this year weren't released until a typically late time, so we didn't see those permits released until the end of February, which effectively meant cattle weren't being exported during the months of January and February in any big numbers. So we're now at March and we're really playing catch-up. You know, there's effectively 3 months' worth of cattle being exported in the 1 month, which will contribute to big numbers. You know, in years gone by, years where we may have had a later wet season or a lighter wet season, there's been up to 25,000 head exported out of Dalrymple sale yards during the month of January. So we didn't see that happen this year, which is obviously why it's catching up in March.
High temperatures have forced oyster farmers to close a south coast New South Wales estuary for harvest. Water temperatures have reached 29 degrees in parts of Murrumbidgee Lake in the past week, and experts say this will be more common with the effects of climate change. Dominic Boyton from Murrumbidgee Gourmet Oysters says he's never seen extended high temperatures like this in the estuary.
We've had just unseasonably warm water, and it's created algae blooms and all sorts of strange things happening out on the water. So we, Murrumbidgee Lake, just went, we're going to close, precautionary, make sure our oysters are good. And the shelf life on them at the moment is limited because they're really fat and we just don't want to push our luck.
Was that a decision made in consultation with the Food Authority around a precautionary closure?
It was, and the other farmers, and we just decided Murrumbidgee sells a lot of oysters, so we just wanted to make sure we kept our good reputation and kept everyone safe.
And sticking with seafood, Australians are among the largest consumers of tinned tuna in the world, eating around 50,000 tonnes every year, which is roughly the weight of the Sydney Harbour Bridge. But if you look on the shelves of major supermarkets, none of the tuna is canned in Australia, and a large amount is not certified as sustainably caught. But the winner of the AgriFuture Queensland Rural Woman of the Year Award, Kate Lamonson, and her husband Rowan are working to change that with their business, Little Tuna.
This didn't sit well with me at all, considering how much tuna we were consuming and how much tuna I know households consume. So we started manufacturing our own. It's in a glass jar, so it's quite unique. It's quite a boutique product. However, we are looking at expanding and getting more fishermen's product on the shelf. So we're looking at increasing our range and having the opportunity to have more tuna fishers fish on the supermarket shelf.
I imagine setting up something like this has a lot of challenges.
My background is accounting, my husband's background is fishing. So it took a lot of trial and error to perfect our recipe. We had a high benchmark and we wanted to hit that. We wanted the product to be absolutely perfect. And once we had hit that, we launched it just to our friends. Then the local businesses started buying it, and then we started selling it domestically, and then we got it on our website, and now we're in over 150 stores across Australia, and we also sell online.
And that's today's Rural News.
Thanks, Jane. Jane McNaughton there with Rural News. Let's head to the Bureau now. Senior forecaster Michael Efron is on the line. Afternoon, Michael.
Good afternoon, Angus.
Michael, we've had, well, in Horsham, I think we had the princely sum of about 7 drops of rain this morning, so just the smallest of little sprinklings about the traps.
That's right. Fairly light falls across most of Victoria overnight and into this morning, but we have seen some pockets receive some higher totals through Gippsland, where it has been really dry as well. We saw 12 millimetres at Mount Monappa, not far from Bairnsdale, also Mullacoota, 12 millimetres to 9 a.m. And since 9 a.m, we've seen further falls around 1 to 5 millimetres through Gippsland, 6 at Mullacoota, and Bairnsdale is leading the totals across the state, 12 millimetres. Also, some very patchy falls through western parts of the Mallee and Wimmera, around 1 or 2 millimetres there. But for the rest of today, we're going to see that patchy rain contracting east, and I don't think we'll see significant totals. I think that Gippsland High Country area is a chance at the highest falls through the rest of this afternoon. Also, in the far northeast, we could see some thunderstorm activity developing, and that could deliver locally 5 to 15 millimetres. But elsewhere, we'll see southerly winds freshening. And for the northwest of the state, some relief in terms of temperatures compared to the last week, when we saw temperatures generally in the mid to high 30s. So today, Mildura expecting 31. Bendigo 28, Seymour 30, elsewhere Wangaratta 30 degrees, Hamilton a top of 26, Warrnambool and Ballarat 25, and across in Gippsland, Salem Bairnsdale 23 degrees. So a lot cooler in the north of the state today. And then as we head into Friday, we will see that shower activity tending to clear, and we may still see some afternoon showers and storms in the far northwest, and also a morning shower or two through Gippsland. But for the rest of the state, pretty good conditions with winds tending easterly, so it will warm up a bit in the south compared to today. And we will see plenty of sunshine through central parts of the state. And then as we head into the weekend, we are going to see the winds tending northeasterly. So Saturday and Sunday, we'll see temperatures climbing into the low 30s across the north, high 20s in the south. Generally dry conditions, although I think each afternoon and into the evening, we will see some isolated showers and thunderstorms developing near and north of the divide. So not a widespread event, but something to keep an eye on there. And it does become a little bit more humid as well through the weekend. Then as we head into Monday, we see a low pressure trough approaching from the west. And with that, we could still see some isolated showers and storms developing in the north during the afternoon. Quite warm across the state, temperatures about 29 to 33 degrees. And then on Tuesday, we see the trough to the west crossing Victoria. And so we'll see northerly winds shifting cooler southwesterly later in the day. But with that trough moving in, we will see some showers and storms developing. There is some potential for some moderate totals if you are under one of those thunderstorms. But ahead of that, a pretty warm day again, temperatures in the high 20s or low 30s. And then next Wednesday, we see southerly winds extending across all of the state. So temperatures through southern districts will be back in the high teens or low 20s, and across the north, low to mid-20s, and some isolated showers around in the south. So it does look like a fairly warm spell coming up ahead of that change arriving later on Tuesday.
That southerly change on Tuesday into Wednesday, Michael, is that going to spell the end of our summer weather?
I wouldn't say so just at this point. I think even into the early part of April, we can certainly get some warm days. So still a chance, I think, as we head towards Easter, of those temperatures pushing into the 30s across the state.
Better leave it there. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Angus.
Michael Efron there, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau, updating you on everything that's happening and that's coming up weather-wise.
On ABC Radio Victoria, this is the Victorian Country Hour.
Let's stay on weather, because despite almost no rain, apart from those sprinkles today, for more than 6 weeks in many parts of the state, deep soil moisture has barely declined at all. That's according to Agriculture Victoria's Soil Moisture Probe Network. That is, of course, another reminder of the benefit of good summer weed control in preserving moisture, even when it doesn't rain. Dale Boyd, seasonal risk agronomist with Agriculture Victoria, says while soil has dried out on top, moisture from those big rains in the Christmas New Year period is safely stored below.
When we're looking at the soil moisture, all the results are drawing back to what happened in late November, and there's been rain events obviously around Christmas time and then events through January as well. So all pretty cured on top at the moment, but deep soil moisture was able to build up with those four events that were around end of last year and the start of this year.
And just looking at some of your probes, the likes of Oyen, Normanville, Brim, Birchip, Canoa Bridge, Raywood, most of those are all still around that 100% deep soil moisture.
Yeah, that's right. Yep, that's deep moisture. There's probably some contributing factors to all of those sites. Some were in vetch or brown manure, so they certainly had a fair carryover of soil moisture with limited crop use from last year. And probably, just around Canoa Bridge, canola last year. So I've certainly noted that you know, in previous years, canola's been pretty aggressive in its moisture depletion. And generally, after that canola crop, you might be starting off at a lower soil moisture status for the following crop. That's not the case at Canoa Bridge. It's had a good solid build-up over those rain events. And, yeah, whether it's 100% or, you know, 85%, we've certainly been able to track with those individual sensors that moisture's got, you know, infiltrated back down to 80 centimetres with those significant cells, storm cells that floated over through November and December and January.
So what the probes are telling us then is that despite the fact that it hasn't rained for most parts since January, there's been really no reduction or very little reduction in that deep soil moisture?
Yeah, that's correct. So the probe started 30 centimetres. We've seen that in the past, that with adequate summer weed control, that moisture's pretty safely positioned below at those depths over the past few years. And historically seeing that, we'd certainly acknowledge that from 0 to 10, it's got to be pretty dry and crusty, and it's probably getting picked up as the soil testing and deep end analysis is being conducted in the past month. And as the dry continues, we'll probably start to see that moisture, from 10 centimetres, probably just, moving down, being lost from maybe down to 15 and 20 centimetres. So it will take some sort of rain event to bring it back up and bring those topsoil moistures back up to an adequate position.
And Dale, we've talked about excellent soil moisture in most areas, but Not the case everywhere. I note that your Hamilton probe's showing pretty low deep soil moisture.
Yeah, there's certainly some districts out there that haven't been part of those storm cells that have been moving around. That's probably just the nature of them. Fairly hit and miss. A lot of those permanent pasture sites have probably never seen so much red around that southwest site and down towards Gippsland, so just reflecting the dry nature that we've experienced in the last 6 weeks and pastures actively, depleting those resources that were laid down in late spring, you'd say, yeah.
So overall, Dale, as people are probably dusting off their air seeders and preparing to start sowing pretty soon, how would you describe the positioning of cropping country in terms of deep soil moisture?
Yeah, well, I'm optimistic, and I think just the essential thing is just to have those air seeders dusted off and ready to go. I think timing's got to be, as always, such a critical component. Seize the windows that do pop up for opportunities to sow, and if there's germinating rains, probably may take 1 to 2 rains to get it connected up. It's never in play until it is connected up, but hopefully we can see that connected up sometime in that autumn or early winter, and then that really sets the season up to have that extension of the root system exploring to depth and picking up where the moisture is.
Dale Boyd from AgVic there. 12 to 1, this is the Country Hour. And Australia's largest wine producer says it's about 5 years away from operating its vineyards using autonomous machinery. Treasury Wine Estates began trialling robotic tractors with a company called Swarm Farm in 2020. 4 years on, Halsey Kennedy caught up with the company's regional viticulture manager, Ben Harris, to find out how those trials have been going.
So we've got a number of robotic trials globally. We've been working since 2020 with Swarm Farm, with Bravo 2. So that's a robot we're trialling at Coonawarra. We've got approximately another year on that sort of that lease and that trial, which we're doing in partnership with Wine Australia and PERSA. But we're also doing work with another company, Robotics Plus, which commenced in the US and New Zealand. But we're also got some trials going on in Australia as well. So, but we're trialling a number of robots in the Napa in the US, as well as in France, New Zealand and Australia, and trying to learn from all those robots and all those trials and figure out how we advance and how we scale up.
What have been the biggest challenges with bringing a robot into the vineyard?
The biggest problems we're sort of currently working through is that, you know, these are very safe robots and there's a lot of safety features with obstacle detection and how it navigates the vineyard safely. And with vines, there's narrow rows and there's a lot of chutes and there's a lot of things that the very sensitive obstacle detection detects. So I've been working with Swarm Farm in, you know, how do we train the robots to recognise the difference between a chute from a vine and an obstacle that the robot needs to work for. So it's, you know, the core functions of the robots is there. It's just really how do we tweak it to make sure it works efficiently in the vineyard. At the moment, every time there's an obstacle, it stops, which is great because we don't want it hitting things. And then on a phone or an iPad, the people overseeing the robots can see why it stopped and either override it and start it again or go check it out. So, and it's just probably overly sensitive at this stage, but, you know, would rather start at that point for safety reasons and then work with Swarm Farm to, I suppose, get that obstacle detection in a way that is that perfect balance between safety and efficiency.
Can you tell me a little bit about Treasury Wine Estate's vision for bringing these robots onto its vineyards? What are you aiming for here? Where are you hoping to be in 5 years' time and in 10 years' time?
There's a couple of priorities. One is sustainability. How do we sort of, you know, obviously we have a lot of tractors, and so how do we sort of improve our sustainability through either hybrids or electrifying our fleet? So that is a priority for us, as well as we're seeing in all regional areas, it's harder and harder to find people. So, you know, we can see that the labour market is going to get more and more challenging. And so how can we utilise automation to help that? You know, and so in, I suppose, 5 years, I can see us transitioning to, I suppose, a more sustainable tractor or robot in the vineyard, and which also will enable us to do, I suppose, certain practices with a lower footprint and enable us to think differently about how we undervine mow in vineyards, how we trim in vineyards. So have an efficient automated way of doing that with some sort of environmental and sustainability benefits.
Okay. And is that something you're hoping to roll out across all of Treasury Wine Estate's vineyards, or is it something that might work in some areas but not others? Or
yeah, I think there's solutions for every area, but I don't know if it's going to be the same solution for every area. So, you know, that's why we're working with a number of different robots, trying to figure out which robot is suited for which region or which vineyard or which setup, and also the skill set we require for that sort of future vision.
That was Treasury Wine Estates Regional Viticulture Manager Ben Harris speaking with Elsie Kennedy. It's been nearly 4 years since the federal government ruled the government's 2011 live export ban to Indonesia was unlawful, but members of that successful class action are still waiting for compensation. The Federal Ag Minister Murray Watt has been in Darwin this week, and the NT Country Hour's Matt Brann asked him where the cattle industry's compo money was.
I absolutely understand the frustration that people are experiencing with this case having run as long as it has.
Nearly and, 4 years now.
Well, I mean, if you go back, it's over 10 years.
From 2011,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, it's over 10 years. So it's a long time for people to wait. And, you know, I would make the point that obviously it wasn't our government that decided to run that case to trial. It was the former government that did that. But I recognise that it's now our responsibility to resolve the matter.
Yeah. And it was your government that banned the trade illegally
right.
in 2011.
It goes back to those decisions back in 2011. And you know, I've not only spoken with the Cattlemen's Association, but I've spoken with a number of individual graziers, both here in the Northern Territory and also Northwest Queensland, about the impact that has had on people.
And it's the length of time. I mean, your background is in law yep. and in class actions.
Yeah.
Is it normal for a federal court to make a decision and nearly 4 years later no payout. Is that normal?
It can, having worked in this space myself before I was in politics, it can, class actions do tend to be long running cases. And because the amount of money that's involved is very large, obviously sometimes it can take a fair while to settle a case. But you know, I have spoken previously with the Attorney General, Mark Dreyfus, who has carriage of this litigation, and said to him that I would like to see this resolved as quickly as possible. I think it's also worth noting that the federal government did put a settlement offer on the table back in December 2022. That was only a few months after we were elected. And that was over $200 million to settle the case.
Yeah.
I recognise that
less than half of what the industry is calling for.
Yeah, well, obviously different parties are going to have different views about what the damages are.
So when the cattle industry comes out and says no to your offer, we want more like $510 million plus interest and so forth, do you personally look at that number and call BS? Do you think that's way too much?
No, look, I'm not. I guess I'm not close enough to the case to know, and I haven't reviewed the evidence to understand exactly what the price is worth, if you want to put it that way. But that's why we have lawyers involved. That's why we have courts involved to make those kind of decisions. As I say, we did put a settlement offer forward a few months after we were elected. You know, people might not like to hear it, but it took 12 months before we got a counter offer from the claimants in that case. So I don't think it's fair to say that all of the delay has been on the government side. I think there were issues with the lawyers acting for the claimants in terms of preparing a counter offer. And that counter offer was made just before Christmas last year, so 12 months later. And as you say, that was seeking over $500 million plus interest and costs, which would take it into several hundred million.
800 to 900 million.
It could well be in that figure. And I guess the thing I would also say is that, you know, as a representative of the Australian taxpayer, as a minister, I've got to make a decision, and we've got to make decisions as governments about what is a fair use of taxpayers' money. You know, anything in the hundreds of millions of dollars is a seriously big commitment, and we've got to be able to justify that. So I would like to think that we can come up with a reasonable compromise, but it does take two parties to do that.
Ag Minister Murray Watt speaking there with Matt Brann. Let's head to markets now, starting today at Hamilton with Chris Agnew.
Thanks, Angus. Agents yarded 3,500 sheep at Hamilton, an increase of 1,700 on last week's small offering. Most of the sheep on offer were trade weight merinos with only a few pens of heavy crossbreeds. Not all the processors were present, and only four were active in a market that was generally firm to 5 to 10 dearer over most categories. The general run of mutton to average between 200 to 260 cents, crossbred used to $78, well-covered merino use also made to $78, and the merino weathers to $75. Hoggets up to $56 per head. At Hamilton, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Chris. Bairnsdale Cattle now with Brendan Fletcher.
G'day, Angus. Numbers decreased to 370. That's 180 fewer than the sale of a fortnight ago, with a small field of buyers operating selectively in a cheaper market. Quality declined, with secondary and plainer cattle well supplied. Trade cattle slipped 20 to 40 cents. Heavy manufacturing steers eased 5. Ground steers and bullocks eased 5 to 10. Cows gave back 15 to 25 cents, with processors loading cows for an estimated 283 to 450 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy bulls eased 13 cents. Veal is sold from 220 to 280, with several pens passed in. Yearling trade steers reached 265 for just a handful. Heifers sold up to 260. Ground steers 280 to 282. There are only a few pens. Heavy manufacturing steers 198 to 280. Most light and medium weight cows 73 to 200 cents, heavyweights 150 to 239, heavy bulls 190 to 232. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Brendan. Now let's see what's been happening at Wagga Lambs with Leanne Dax.
Good afternoon. The market at Wagga was volatile with significant rate fluctuations. Buyers navigated through a mixed quality offering of 39,000 lambs with many unfinished or with longer wool. and these types were discounted. Feedlot buyers targeted well-bred, shorter-skinned lambs in trade weight classes. However, competition for trade was inconsistent, leading to price drops. Lambs weighing 20 to 24 softened $3, selling from $90 to $154, and averaging 607 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy lambs saw increased interest, with 26 to 30 holding firm at $155 to $203, while those over 30 kilos lifted by $6, fetching $190 to $241. Merino lambs ranged from $52 to $124. Store lambs dipped $12, and light lambs for the processors decreased by $10 to $13, with substantial drops in isolated sales. With the sheep sale yet to commence, some Leanne Ducks for MLA.
Thanks, Leanne. Just about it for the Country Hour. Kevin at Myrtleford says a sprinkle of rain overnight at Myrtleford, but nothing in the gauge. About the same here in Horsham. News time, 1 o'clock.